Just a reminder, we've covered the private sector contribution towards the health sector and development of it in Cindy's comments, the empowering consumers and the relationship with the medical profession and the unleashing of data with Paul, how you actually be customer-centric with Barry and the longer-term future and the kind of big waves that may affect the industry that is private health insurance with Andrew. So anyone want to pose a question or a view or follow up with one of the speakers initially? I shall take a show of hands, and there's one at the back.
G'day there, Stuart Oldfield, Field Research. Perhaps starting with Paul, you ended your talk on a reference to ideally keep premium increases close to inflation. I'd just like to get your thoughts on how well we're going to achieve that objective in the next couple of years.
I'm probably the wrong person to answer that, but I mean, I will say that CPI is running about 2 or 3%. You know, premiums typically are about double that. I'm sure that for Bupa and also the larger companies here, that we price really based on cost trend. And cost trend for both private and the public is running at significantly above the actual CPI rate. Now, there's an interesting discussion you can have as to how much, you know, consumers would be willing to pay. And I've heard the position put forward, and I must admit I have a bit of sympathy for it, that you see the US expenditure on GDP as being 15-16%, Australia's about 10, sort of in the middle of the pack, or maybe higher. Then maybe wealthier countries are, you know, and consumers are willing to spend more money on health, so maybe it's okay. And some parts of those changes are inevitable. You can't do anything about aging and new treatments, essentially. So to some extent, we will accept that. But I do think that longer term, and so that's not going to happen in the next couple of years, to answer your question directly, it has to get closer to CPI than it is today. And I think that we as a system, not just the funders, but everyone, providers, consumers, have to strive to make the system as efficient as it could be. So that's I suppose, is where I just sort of think most about it. How do we avoid cost shifting? How do we ensure that people get the right operations and feel they're getting quality care?
Anyone else want to have a go at that?
I think the other thing that we as an industry, most industries have learnt is we might say we're where we are because we do consistency every year, generally. We keep them within a bandwidth. But it actually, consumers do react very differently to huge increases one year and basically a 1% the next year. So, you know, there are some elements about how we engage with consumers when there are big movements.
Yeah. And I think the conversation needs to definitely move away from price to the value of the offer itself, because people are so focused on the price, and that is probably the only thing that is tangible in there from their perspective. So able to demonstrate the value in a way that they can understand the experience, I think, is critical as well.
My comment on it would be, look, let's not lose perspective. I often say to our team, remember what's important. What do I want in the health system? I want the optimum care when I need it, and I want optimum care at an efficient cost so there's no waste. I don't want us to achieve CPI increases by, you know, as Paul said, we don't want to do cost shifting. CPI increases and shifting more cost to the consumer isn't really a win giving optimum care. So it's really about finding the balance of remembering this is about optimum care for patients when they need it at an efficient cost.
I'm going to push this topic just a little bit further, widening it out to affordability, but I'm going to assume that the kind of health services available to a private health insurance member today are much wider, more up to date, do new things that wasn't the case 20 years ago or 25 years ago, 1991. In other words, the consumer is getting more services now than they did 25 years ago. Couple that with, it does seem to be the case that as our disposable income grows, our personal priorities are to spend a disproportionate share of that on being well. So if you take those two things, and then which lead to spending more on your health, and then you look at the way we package it up as a premium and we want to compare premium with CPI, how can you possibly keep the premium growing at CPI if you keep buying more services? Or the other way around, how can you possibly keep your customers happy if you package all these new services up in one price so you invite them to compare it with the CPI? It seems to me this affordability issue that you've raised has a basic paradox that the industry has to resolve in the amount of services we now supply and the growing amount of services. We'll package it up as one price. Any comment on that?
I would say we as an industry need to get much better at educating consumers about health in general and how they consume health. So to that end, 25 years ago, with the number of DRGs that existed, only 50% would have been done in a private hospital and would have been covered simply because they weren't provided in a private hospital. There are now only 3 DRGs that are not done in private hospitals. Now, they're not done consistently, and they are mainly transplant DRGs that still tend to sit within the realm of a public hospital. But, you know, to your point, so consumers could still access them. They just access them in a different system. Now they can access everything except for the trauma care and the odd transplant in the private sector. So that is very true. It's also the difference about what we as consumers are prepared to pay for. So I don't know about you, I've just bought my second Fitbit for the year because, you know, I travel a lot and I lose it periodically in hotel rooms, and heaven forbid I would lose it if I was out running, actually doing what I'm supposed to be doing with it. But, you know, I don't actually think that much about, in all honesty, going and paying $100 for another Fitbit. But if you tell me my premium just went up $100 in a month, I don't see value in that. So we do have to have a much better dialogue about making it something that consumers actually want.
It is an interesting question. I think you're right to draw out the paradox, which is that I'll tell you that the pain point for our members when premium rates go up, and that at the moment there is pressure for downgrades and discontinuances at higher rates than we've seen previously. So there's definitely, you know, there is a pain point for consumers. On the other hand, I think the paradox of human behaviour too is that when you're sick, you hate the premium increases, but when you're well, you hate the premium increases. When you're sick, you're very pleased you've got some insurance. And how, you know, elastic our willingness is to pay for premiums is also unknown. I mean, there was this study which I, you know, was thinking of as I made my comment before, which showed developed countries as a percent of GDP spent on health versus undeveloped countries, and there's a pretty straight line. So maybe we are willing to pay it, but certainly I think the demand from our customers is to get as close as we can to the CPI and to actually work hard to remove inefficiencies, so at least we're getting the best value for dollar.
I think understanding the motivation behind consumers is also very important as well. So when we ask people to change their behaviour, when you look at junk food and McDonald's and things like that, there's a lot of cause of not eating junk food, but people are still eating junk food. So we need to find the right motivation for people to change that behaviour. So you talk about cause and demand and supply and demand, and controlling demand, I think, especially in the utilisation sense, people truly finding the right motivation to tell people what is the right behaviour, what is not so right behaviour, getting that motivation right is critical.
I think it's well covered.
Okay. There was another question down the side here. Can you wait for... Oh, you've got the microphone.
Yeah, thanks. Andrew, you talked about our policyholders, members, getting the optimum care, and yes. I couldn't agree with you more. But when you look at it, we as insurers, in my view, are passive payers, and we have no control or influence on the quality of the care that's given. So a member might go to a physiotherapist who'll give the optimum, or a physiotherapist that won't give the optimum, or a surgeon. So my question to the panel is, how do we as an industry get more involved in the coordination and involved in the process of making sure we actually do become a purchaser of the optimum care for our policyholders?
I'll have a go at that if you like. It's a really good question, and I think one that we, I don't say we struggle with, because we have those conversations at Bupa as well, as you would expect. We see it as being part of our role to assist consumers in making that choice. When I was at United Healthcare, I mean, I've been lucky enough to work in the States, which is an extraordinarily sophisticated healthcare market, really bad in many respects, and you'd never actually use it as a model for healthcare, but it's the most fascinating system to work in, because it's kind of like, I used to compare it to a person driving a car around a city with the choke on completely out, so the petrol consumption is hopeless, but they're driving really skillfully around it. So there's perfect storm for innovation. But what United would do in that space was had access to quite sophisticated analytics, would develop expert panels, and more or less create sort of quality measurements. Extremely hard to do. You know, I will tell you, having sort of worked through the algorithms with them, it's very, very difficult. But I think we're on a journey to that in Australia. And I think that the starting that we've, I think accreditation programs are a start of that. It's a sign that actually it's a way that GPs or even other healthcare providers can actually start a move towards more quality service. I think the work on, together with the College of Surgeons, what we've seen in terms of data analysis, is also a start to that. I mean, I think it doesn't happen at one go, but I think the awareness is there from our side as it's part of our role, and I know that it's at the colleges as part of their mission too, and everyone's very cautious about it, but I think you'll see that direction grow. We haven't really figured out yet how to master big data in the country. Our data is awfully fragmented. We haven't really figured out how to use the PCHR, which I think is a good thing, but we haven't used it at all effectively, but I think it creates the right infrastructure for better work. So I guess we're... And the last thing I'll say is that what United did too, which I think was a good thing as well, was had effectively centres of excellence. So an example would be people with rare cancers who we know are much better treated in facilities that have, you know, relatively high volumes of those things. The outcomes are much better. Even people with hip and knee surgery, there are pretty good and robust measures for what represents quality care for those. A certain number of procedures per year per facility is associated with better healthcare outcomes. And the work in registries, which has patient-reported measures as well, is also in that space. So I think the right movements are happening, but it's going to take quite some time because it's complicated. Mm. We're extremely change-resistant in Australia, and especially the medical profession. And we don't have great data, and I do think it's a fair criticism that I hear commonly, but I think it's a fair one, that the system was designed for episodic care, not chronic care, and we struggle with that.
I think that... Come back to the statement I made, which was optimum care at efficient cost. How do we get there? I think what Paul's pointed to is the messiness of this. You can't do it alone. PHI can't do this. I said optimum care is what I want as a patient, or I want for patients. It has to be provided by the system. So we shouldn't assume PHI can do it alone, but we should flip to... it's a bit like farmers can't make crops grow, but they can create the conditions for growth. So what can PHI do that creates the conditions for optimum care at efficient cost? And I think there's two really... There's a lot of things, but there's two that stand out. And I like to think of what ones can I contribute to. But the first is relationships and connections. This is an industry that is not going to work if the parts of it aren't connected. So PHI and Medibank can play, and Bupa and others, and Defence can play a role in making those connections better. The second one is things like transparency of data. If we can't stop, if we can't make efficient cost, we can create the conditions for it by showing up where it's inefficient, by making the information transparent to consumers, and as James pointed out, to play, and Paul pointed out, to players in the system. Doctors and others, if they get the information and the data, I'm pretty confident they'll act on it. So the conditions would be better connections and more informed.
And I think just to that, as an industry, I think we are getting better at having mature conversations about what we bring to the table. So the elephant in this room, no matter what we do, someone will say, we're doing managed care. Mm. Well, we're all for care that is well managed. And we have to have that conversation. So the work with the College of Surgeons, the work when Medibank started the cardiac registry and funded it because nobody in the public sector would fund a registry in cardiac surgery, the new creation through iCHOM of standard sets for good clinical care that apply across the country and aren't used just to avoid payment, they're used to better manage the care that is delivered, both in public and private. You know, that collaboration of discussion, I think we need to get much better at having with a united front, because we've all got the same outcome. That's not the space we're actually fighting in from a consumer-driven market.
I think I'll also add health literacy to the conversation as well, because I mean, we talk about empowering consumers a lot, but if they don't really understand the information in front of them, it's very hard for them to use that information in the first place. So I think there's definitely a role for, well, not just health insurers, but like for all parties in the health system to improve the health literacy of our consumers.
Okay, I'm going to move on from that issue because a few hands went up suddenly and there's one at the back.
Hayden Burnham.
There's a couple here too, so we've got more questions than we now have time for.
Hayden Burnow from Causeway. For me, one of the big themes that came through many of the talks was about relationships in the health system between private health insurers and other stakeholders. There were so many words around, you know, we want to work together and not against you, and words like collaboration and shared and joint. So my question... And there was, you know, Cindy spoke about relationship between PHIs and government. Barry talked about relationship between PHIs and customers. James talked about relationship between PHIs and the medical profession and hospitals. And so if we take those four relationships as an example, my question to the panel is, how would you rank the current state of the relationship between an average private health insurer and those four other stakeholders? So government, customers, medical profession and hospitals. And if we were to choose one of those to improve for the biggest bang for the buck, which of the four would it be?
You ask good questions here. Right. I've got to tell you. Right. Very challenging question, but I'll have a go.
Government?
Look, I think you said PHI and government. I think it's about average at the moment. I mean, we have disagreements over the level of rebate support, and concerns about, I suppose, cost shifting to private health insurance and therefore our members. From the state point of view, we do see cost shifting occurring with a strong effort, and I think Cindy referred to some examples of really sort of pushing people to get private insurance in a state system when there's probably a little benefit to the actual member in doing so, but just create straight inflation for the rest of the group. But in the profession, I think it's pretty good. And I have to say, like, I learned something when I came back to Australia. I was in the States for a long time, and I came back to Australia really expecting quite aggressive relationships between the payers and the profession, which I'd seen in the States. Now, it's not a great relationship between ourselves and the AMA, but it is good between ourselves and the colleges. And I think we've worked together very productively, as has Medibank, and I'm sure the other funds as well. And so I think that that's good. Customers, we're not popular. As an industry, PHI is not popular with customers. We work on a measurement called NPS. You're probably familiar with it. It's a common industry score, Net Promoter Score. And across the industry, I'm guessing the average Net Promoter Score is minus 30 to minus 40, which means that more people dislike what you do than like what you do, and we consider that unsustainable. And so I'd say for us the most important one is to get connections with customers. I agree with Cindy that we've got to actually work hard to explain our value proposition to them, because I think it's often underrated. That's the one that we work most hard at. All are important though.
Okay. We've reached the end of the time available for this session, which is a pity because there's three more people who have a view on which is the most bang for your buck to work on the relationship. There's four or five other people who have an issue they want to test this panel's opinion on. But We've given it as far as we can, and I think they've done a terrific job. We're going to break for morning tea now. Can I ask you to make sure that you answer the SMS questions? We'll be back here at 11:40. And on that note, can we please give a big thank you to our four presenters in this session?